Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. And I'll begin with a featured article from the magazine, The Ancient Art of Falconry at the Jersey Shore. How Ocean City cleared the gulls from its boardwalk with falcons and hawks. Story by Andrew S. Lewis. The war between humans and gulls in Ocean City, New Jersey, reached a turning point in 2019. In the years leading up to then, the town's population of great black-backed, ring-billed, laughing and herring gulls had become increasingly comfortable snatching beachgoers' French fries, potato chips, and other finger foods. One day that spring, Ocean City's Mayor Jay Gillian watched as a gull swooped into a stroller on the boardwalk and stole a slice of pizza from a toddler's hands. The mayor swears he saw blood on the little girl's face. He admits it may have been sauce. The town's brand, its slogan is America's Greatest Family Resort, was being sullied. That was it for the mayor. I'd seen too many attacks on seniors and kids, Gillian told me earlier this year. He asked his business administrator, George Savastano, to find a solution. Savastano searched online for something like how to deter seagulls, and after skipping over links for spike strips, sound machines, and netting, fixes that had already been tried with scant success by various businesses in Ocean City, he happened upon a video showing the use of raptors to deter gulls, crows, pigeons, and other so-called nuisance birds from places like airports and garbage dumps. But Savastano told me, I couldn't come across any situation exactly like ours. He emailed an inquiry to a New Jersey-based outfit called East Coast Falcons anyway. A few days later, its owner, Eric Swanson, showed up to assess the situation. We get a lot of people that think they have a bird problem, and they don't, Swanson says. And then I have a lot of people that say they have a little bird problem, and I see this. He returned a few days later in his Ford F-150 pickup with a lone white and gray mottled Gur prairie falcon, an adolescent named Tilda. Swanson guided the raptor, a hybrid of the Arctic Gur falcon and Western U.S. prairie falcon, which can dive at speeds of around 100 miles an hour, onto his leather glove fist and walked with Savastano and Gillian up into the boardwalk. The mood in the sky suddenly changed. You could hear the gulls start calling, Savastano says, like, wah, wah. Guess what? Savastano recalls Swanson telling him, they know they're now prey. Swanson was demonstrating for Savastano a modern version of one of the oldest known manipulations of nature by man, falconry. Traditionally understood as the art of trapping and training wild raptors, predominantly falcons, hawks, eagles, and owls, to fly to and from a human handler while hunting small game. 4,000-year-old petroglyphs in Iran depict horsemen with birds perched on their arms. Marco Polo's chronicler, writing about the explorer's travels through the 13th-century Mongol Empire, noted that while the women did all the household buying and selling, the men all lead the life of gentlemen, troubling themselves about nothing but hunting and hawking. In 1492, Columbus gave hawks bells or falconry accoutrement to some indigenous Americans. Falconry didn't become established in the United States until the early 20th century. John Goodall, the executive director of the Archives of Falconry at the World Center for Birds of Prey, located in Boise, Idaho, notes that early American falconers lacked the generational knowledge of their old world counterparts, hobbyists from the aristocratic classes. Instead, American falconry became more aligned with the country's burgeoning conservation movement, which included figures like the wildlife ecologist Aldo Leopold and his student Frances Hammerstrom. Both were falconers, and she helped establish the Raptor Research Foundation. We were almost restarting this ancient sport, Goodell says. Savastano hired Swanson and his team of Falconers more or less on the spot. The birds were an instant sensation. Crowds followed the handlers as they patrolled the boardwalk, letting their raptors soar freely into the air, going from rooftop to signpost and back to the fist, as Falconers put it. The birds of prey, their hunger kept at bay with carefully measured chunks of mouse, rabbit, or quail, were uninterested in killing the gulls, though when one got close enough, they could not help toying with it, giving high-speed chase or diving suddenly at it. But mostly, the gulls kept their distance, returning only when the raptors went away, a back and forth that made for good business. By the next summer, several rival falconry abatement firms were bidding for the lucrative Ocean City contract, but the town retained Swanson, locking in East Coast falcons at a rate, as of this year, of $1,993.42 a day, with a maximum budget of $250,000. As Goodell says, abatement's a growing sector. It's a really innovative, creative way to deal with pests without much worse tools. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given the sport's ancient roots, there's a debate among falconers over whether abatement counts as true falconry. This is a hunting sport, and falconry is defined as hunting wild prey with trained raptors, says Scott McNeff, a past president of the North American Falconers Association, the largest falconry membership organization in the world. And if you're not actively hunting, then it's not falconry. Though he considers abatement a win-win because of its relatively bloodless effectiveness, McNeff says the debate is stoked by a growing concern for the sport's future. 2010, UNESCO first added falconry to its Intangible Cultural Heritage of Humanity list, calling it an age-old drama. Since then, according to McNeff, the international falconry community has been careful to distinguish between falconry and abatement in order to protect the UNESCO-recognized version of the sport, which is in accord with NAFA's ethics policy. It states that falconry should not include the keeping of birds of prey as pets or prestige items. That's because in recent years, especially in Europe, groups like People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals have criticized the use of raptors for shows or demonstrations. On its British website, PETA states, "Falconers treat birds of prey, such as falcons, owls, and eagles, as living props and put them on display for tourists, tied to a block of wood with a short leather strap for hours or even days. Their life is one of boredom and torment." For the gulls, however, Swanson's current 5 hawks, 12 falcons, and Eurasian eagle owl are much better than the typical alternative. In 2021 alone, the U.S. Department of Agriculture killed 17,633 gulls in the name of wildlife control, along with 2,664 hawks, 510 falcons, and 359 owls. You come in here and knock out 20,000 gulls. Well, that's 20,000 less birds to clean up the beach. Swanson says, "Everything is here for a reason." One of those reasons, argues Amanda Rodewald, an avian biologist at Cornell University, is the presence of people, like it or not. Connections are complicated, she says. In removing one species, it can be difficult to predict what the consequences are going to be for others in that system. We don't know which species are going to be valuable to us someday. The use of raptors to haze nuisance birds appears to have been invented by the British military in the 1940s at an air base in Scotland, where peregrine falcons, whose diving speeds of nearly 200 miles per hour make them the fastest animals in the world, were deployed to chase gulls from the runways. In the following decades, the practice spread to the clearing of herring and ring-billed gulls from a Canadian garbage dump, wood pigeons from an English field planted with cabbage and Brussels sprouts, even crows from the Kremlin. Tom L. Freeman, who's the chair of math and science at Eastern New Mexico University, Ruidoso, and studies diurnal raptors, told me that hawks and falcons are so effective because they are unpredictable in ways that artificial deterrence cannot be. You can put scarecrows out, and they work for a while, he says, but with birds of prey, the animals they go after are going to perceive real danger, dynamic danger. Hawks and falcons are different types of birds. There's a picture here of Swanson. Under it, it says, Swanson prepares lunch for his birds by disemboweling the carcasses of refrigerated quail. He's got long hair, glasses, looks like reading glasses, and a beard salted with gray. Hawks and falcons are different types of birds. Hawks, the bigger of the two, its family, also includes eagles and vultures, prefer to chase prey, then pounce, killing it with their talons. Falcons tend to dive bomb their prey, hitting it first with their talons, then breaking its neck and severing its spine with a notch on their beaks called a terminal tooth. Owls watch from a perch, then attack, crushing prey with their huge feet. All raptors' eyes refresh twice as fast as the human eye, even when the birds are flying at high speeds. Plus, their peripheral vision is mostly, or perhaps completely, clear. Now imagine all that clarity magnified 8 times. If a hawk were sitting in an ophthalmologist chair and looking across the room at a Snellen chart, Freeman says, I suspect they could easily read the copyright notice at the bottom. Swanson likens this power to being able to read a newspaper from a block away. Behavioral plasticity is used by wildlife biologists to describe a species' ability to quickly adapt to new environments and habitat stressors. Gulls and pigeons and crows, rabbits and raccoons, they all share the trait to a high degree. For example, the herring gull, one of the most common of the gull family of seabirds in the American Northeast, has come to understand in an evolutionary blink of an eye that packages handled by humans are likely to contain a meal, and that onion rings, which weren't around 30 million years ago when it was thought this bird emerged, will do just as well as surf clams. Raptors exhibit similar plasticity, most likely, Freeman says, because they are apex predators, motivated by food. A captive Harris's hawk is as happy to take rabbit meat from a human hand as it is from a woodland meadow. This level of comfort, however, has allowed both traditional and abatement falconers to sometimes put their raptors in hazardous situations. Swanson has used his birds to chase pigeons from a tire shop and crows from cemeteries and strip malls. When I first started, it was airports, and that was about it, he said. I can't believe how many different venues have started to pop up. Swanson lives in Lodi, New Jersey, about a 30-minute drive from downtown Manhattan, with his wife Maria and their 17 hawks and falcons, a group of pigeons, 2 dachshunds, and Ozzy, the Eurasian eagle owl. The raptors live in spacious mews that take up much of the small property's side yard. The pool is filled in to make room. During a visit, I watched as Swanson prepared lunch for his birds. He pulled a package of dead quail from the fridge, sat down at the kitchen table, and began disemboweling the carcasses over a trash bin. About a decade ago, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which requires him to use a walking stick when in the field, and has made practicing falconry painful and difficult. But he won't quit. Falconry, he told me, has been a lifestyle all the way through. Swanson was born in Brooklyn, but grew up in Staten Island, where he acquired a reputation as the kid whom neighbors could take injured birds to for rehabilitation. When he discovered the golden eagle at the Staten Island Zoo, he became a regular annoyance to the zookeepers because he found that by feeding the bird mice, he could influence its behavior. By his early teens, he was hopping buses from Port Authority to the Adirondacks for weeks-long sojourns in the mountains. At the time, Swanson was unaware of the novel My Side of the Mountain, about a New York City boy who runs away to the Catskills and finds companionship with a peregrine falcon. He says his experience was less romantic. I just kind of got dirty, took baths in streams, and fished. Back in the city, Swanson fell in with the Guardian Angels, the notorious citizen patrol group. He ranged through Hell's Kitchen and Times Square with a German shepherd in tow. The group's founder, Curtis Sliwa, told me he recalled Swanson from among the scores of young volunteers in the 80s because he said, "We hadn't had many, had that many blonde-haired Guardian Angels." In his 20s, Swanson tried a job in sales at a car dealership, but quickly decided he couldn't wear a monkey suit every day. He went to work for Turtleback Zoo in West Orange, New Jersey, where he was first tasked with animal control for veterinarian visits. Soon after, he was training a golden eagle for educational demonstrations. In his free time, he began trapping and training his own birds. Living in North Jersey, where open space was rapidly being transformed into housing developments and parking lots, Swanson often had to fly his birds in the meadowlands, where methane gas flares from landfills had been known to singe the feathers of both wild raptors and those of other falconers. In 2007, the federal government legalized the use of raptors for commercial bait abatement after the National Fish and Wildlife Service noticed growing interest in the practice. The agency has currently issued 210 special purpose abatement permits to falconers across the United States. Airports are always innovating and looking for new solutions as birds become accustomed to, and thus less responsive to, current non-lethal methods, a Fish and Wildlife representative told me, adding that vineyards and fruit producers are also increasingly turning to abatement falconry. Suddenly, a viable career path opened up to Swanson. And though he has done abatement jobs at places like John F. Kennedy International Airport and a blueberry farm, his position as a falconer of the Northeast megalopolis has also taken him to some strange locales. Some years ago, he was asked to check out a wastewater treatment plant in New York that had become home to a breeding colony of pigeons. But when Swanson released his goshawk, a raptor known for its fierceness, into the affected building, the birds didn't budge. Their stubbornness was understandable. "All the free food we want and nothing comes in after us," is what Swanson imagined the birds thinking. Maybe they thought they found the Taj Mahal. Unwilling to flee from the bird of prey now loose in their home, some of the pigeons were killed and eaten. Jezebel, the goshawk, ended up contracting a host of bacterial and fungal infections, and Swanson also got him sick himself. From his perspective, the place was no Taj. It was Dante's Inferno. In a world where humans so often eliminate pests by extinguishing them, Swanson is proud that he can exert control without killing. He swore off any future jobs that might confront him with the same moral considerations. "I felt terrible," he said, "like I was knocking out this little ecosystem." But accidents still happen. Over the course of a summer in Ocean City, Swanson's hawks and falcons will sometimes go rogue and attack a gull. A couple will get caught every year, he says. You can't stop it. Last season was one of his hawks chased a gull about a mile out to sea, presumably killed it, then tried to swim its body back to shore. All of Swanson's birds are fixed with GPS transmitters, which connect to a smartphone app. He watched as his hawk's beacon moved slowly with the ocean's current. A rescue vessel was dispatched, but Swanson says she was already under. Episodes like these help to fuel the doubts about abatement, both within the falconry community as well as outside of it. Noah Perlut, worries more about the health implications for raptors raised and trained to solve problems for humans that humans themselves have created. Perlett is a professor at the University of New England who studies the impact of the built environment on bird species. He says it's not unusual for a raptor to drown after pursuing a gull only a mile out to sea. That's not very far for a wild, fit raptor, he says. In some ways, that inability to survive and get back to shore may speak to the fitness of that raptor as a captive animal. The image of swarms of gulls lifting pizza slices from the hands of tourists may suggest a species thriving, but that is in fact an illusion. In North America, the gulls family have declined by a little more than 50% in the last 50 years. Perlett's own research on the herring gulls in the Gulf of Maine, some of which spend time at the New Jersey shore, has revealed they have declined by 5% annually for the last 25 years. That the gulls appear to be proliferating is a function of their high behavioral plasticity. How many places between Maine and New Jersey are undeveloped? Very few, Perlett says. So if they want to exist in this distribution, they have to be human-centric. There's no problem with pushing them away from places where they may be inclined to steal junk food from unsuspecting hands, he argues. But we need to think of them dualistically. Let's keep them off the places where they're causing problems, but at the same time, let's make sure that there are places where they're not harassed. He says, I'm not suggesting they're under threat, but they are a declining species. There's a close-up picture after that of a raptor's eyes, and under it it says, all raptor's eyes refresh twice as fast as the human eye, even when the birds fly at high speeds. On the entire American coast, a little over 14,000 miles of ocean, estuary, bay, and tidal river shores, about the distance from New York to Los Angeles and back 2.5 times over, has been hardened by seawalls, bulkheads, and other structures. What makes places like Ocean City special is the overlap between the natural and built environments. One minute you're swimming in the waves, the next you're riding a roller coaster. But there are expanses of ocean today devoid of their former biodiversity. Skies once filled with birdsong are now silent. Beaches are manufactured, replenished with sand, and sculpted to favor the human footprint above all others. Perlett suggests we ask ourselves what a beach would be entirely without gulls trundling along the white edges of the breakers, without the distinct sound of their laughter, without even the rush you get when one is ripping an Italian hoagie from your fingertips. Is the nature we think we see even nature at all? On the Ocean City boardwalk one day in late May, family stood around one of Swanson's falconers, an apprentice, and their Harris's hawk, Karen, who stretched her wings wide in the sea breeze. The sky above was empty. A few laughing gulls patrolled the ocean's edge. Beachgoers carelessly devoured pizza and ice cream. For those who remembered the earlier days of the war between human and gull, this was the most beautiful truce. One woman who was visiting from out of town told me the raptors had finally brought balance. Sometimes we let the pendulum swing too far, she says. Now the gulls know their boundaries. The woman didn't want the birds to disappear. She just wanted them to keep their distance. This is a refrain that Swanson sometimes hears while working the boardwalk. He likes to remind people that gulls are not gone, just somewhere else, eating the clams and crabs and other natural food sources that die and roll up in the surf. Cleaning all that crap off that beach you want to sit on, in other words, performing a service. At least we're not out there with shotguns, he says, shooting everything that moves. Andrew S. Lewis, the author, is a writer who covers environmental issues for New Jersey Spotlight News, and he's also the author of Drowning of Money Island, He last wrote for the magazine about the impact of climate change on the Jersey Shore. Devon Akhtar Yalkin is a photographer based in Los Angeles who's covered diverse subjects for the magazine, including President Joe Biden, Nicholas Berggruen, a German-American investor and philanthropist, and the effects of climate change on the Jersey Shore. And now I'll read a letter of recommendation. The poet who taught me to be in love with the world. Frank O'Hara's greatest legacy might be his secular faith in other people and in everything around us. It's a story by Ada Calhoun. One day, while walking with my husband and a 15-year-old son from the subway to the Central Park Zoo, we passed the William Tecumseh Sherman statue on the park's southeast corner. As one might say, a prayer upon passing a church, I recited the opening of Frank O'Hara's 1954 poem, Music. If I rest for a moment near the equestrian, pausing for a liver sausage sandwich in the Mayflower shop, that angel seems to be leading the horse into Bergdorf's. Growing up in the 1980s in a bohemian East Village family, I knew as if by osmosis about the cohort of 1950s and 60s painters and poets known as the New York School. O'Hara was the one I loved. In the photos and footage of him that I saw, O'Hara looked soft and hard at the same time, part boxer, part librarian, with his crooked nose, wide smile, and light blue eyes. His 1964 book, Lunch Poems, was the closest thing we had to a family Bible. As a young poet, my father met O'Hara, 16 years his senior, at a few parties. At the last, O'Hara inscribed a catalog to him at a Museum of Modern Art opening, with palship from Frank. A month later, on July 25th, 1966, O'Hara was hit by a dune buggy in the middle of the night on Fire Island. In an obituary published in the Village Voice, my father wrote, "Everything about O'Hara is easy to demonstrate and exceedingly difficult to understand, and the aura of the legendary never far from him while he lived now seems about to engulf the memory of all he was and did." When he died, O'Hara was already a key figure in American poetry, and as an unabashedly out man in the 1950s America, a transformative figure in gay cultural history. For the past several decades, he's been the lens through which many people, myself included, see New York City. The poet Ron Padgett calls O'Hara's a voice that often reminded me of bourbon and smoke, nightclubs, a phone call that changes your life, and warmth. His poems always sounded to me like the city feels at its best, cosmopolitan, wry, romantic, full of potential, gimlet-eyed, without being mean. In reaction to a New York Post headline after the actress Lana Turner collapsed from exhaustion, he wrote, "I've been to lots of parties and acted perfectly disgraceful, but I never actually collapsed. Oh, Lana Turner, we love you. Get up." O'Hara's poems have an intoxicating swagger. Even whipshod by snow, by city traffic, by volatile love affairs, he displays a deep delightedness. Getting his heart broken only makes him more adventurous. He's just happy he can be the first person to take you to the Frick. He's grateful he gets to drink too much coffee and smoke too many cigarettes and love you so much. Today I live with my family in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, just another pleasant stranger whose apartment is in the Heaven on Earth building near the Williamsburg Bridge. When I'm walking through the city in the late afternoon, I think, right in front of it, in the warm New York 4 o'clock light, we are drifting back and forth between each other like a tree breathing through its spectacles. My friends who teach writing to college students tell me that O'Hara is a perennial favorite. He's just so funny. He flirted with his friends, with his lovers, with his readers. It was more than a lifestyle, his flirting. It was a calling. As a writer, I learned from him about how far it goes with an audience being game and curious. O'Hara loved people well. The poet Barbara Guest said that he had that quality of a 30s or 40s movie. It's only you and the moonlight, you know? The points to what, for me, is O'Hara's true legacy, his secular religiosity. He had tremendous belief in the value of one person honestly encountering another. Quote, the only truth is face to face, the poem whose words become your mouth. And faith in the world to provide for us, he wrote. And I am out on a limb, and it is the arm of God. He loved the world so much that seeing it through his eyes made me love the world too. And he made me feel safe there. In the agnostic household of my childhood, that O'Hara line was gospel. My parents often said that most choices could be boiled down to security or freedom, and that it was always better to choose freedom. Whatever felt precarious might, as it turned out, be the safest thing in the world. In To the Harbor Master, O'Hara wrote, I trust the sanity of my vessel, an amor fati confidence that might be necessary for anyone with pretensions to be a writer. My whole life, I've made choices that seem surely unwise. I haven't held a job with benefits in 12 years. I married a performance artist. I had a baby with no childcare plan in place. But now here we are on a Saturday, walking through Central Park, surrounded by breathing trees and beckoning statues. And I'm telling my son there is no greater security than being out on the right limb with the right voice in your head. Ada Calhoun is a writer whose latest book is also a poet, Frank O'Hara, My Father and Me. And now I'll read the talk section, interviews by David Marchese. John Grissom is still battling his southern demons. There are very few constants in life, and it sure feels as if the number is shrinking. But one thing readers of popular fiction can count on is that every year will bring a new John Grisham book or two, with his latest sparring partners. The prolific and mega-selling novelist is offering his humble version of a change-up. The book, his 47th, is the 67-year-old's first collection of novellas. It includes three separate stories, one of which features his old standby Southern lawyer character, Jake Briggins. But while his professional life has been marked by a certain steadfastness, his personal and political evolution wasn't quite so smooth. I've come a long way, said Grissom, who was a lawyer and a politician before turning to writing. Once I became a lawyer, most of my clients were poor people, working people, minority people, who had no money. We were on one side of the street. On the other side of the street were the people with money. Real quick, I realized where I stood in life and where I was going to be in life. David asks, with the exception of Strawberry Moon, the material in the new book feels to me like the kind of plots and subject matter that you normally render at full length. And to be crass, I've also heard that novellas don't sell as well as novels, so why opt for the form? And Grissom says, over the years, these stories kept lying around, and I realized that the birthdays are piling up and the stories are not being written. So I said, okay, I'm going to pick out my three favorites and finish them. I'm tired of thinking about them. I emailed Stephen King and said, you've done several collections of novellas. How did it work? He said he also had a lot of stories. You're not going to be able to write them all as novels. Some don't work as short stories. So you do something in the middle. That's how it all came to pass. I can play around with a baseball book or a football book or short stories or a kid's book in my spare time, but I know my readers want the legal thriller every fall. David says, when you know you've got to deliver a big new legal thriller every fall, and in between you're often writing those other books, are you ever able to abandon an idea that isn't working, or do you just have to find a way to make it work? I've never had this situation where I wrote myself into a corner I couldn't get out of. At the same time, with every book, I reach a point late in the game where I have doubts about the story and get nervous, even frightened about who's going to believe this stuff. I'm going through it right now with the boys from Biloxi. My goal each year with each legal thriller is to write about 100,000 words. That's going to produce a novel when published that's about 350 pages. To me, that's ideal. You don't need a big, thick book for a thriller. The boys from Biloxi, I'm at about 120,000 right now and sweating because I have a lot left to cover to get to the end. So yeah, those are issues that come up, but I can't squeeze a novel out of every idea. A perfect example is the opioid crisis. It's right down my alley because it's tons of litigation, corporate bad behavior, all kinds of bad guys. I've been itching to write that book, but I haven't been able to get my head around a story that I could do in 100,000 words. It's just so big. Guantanamo is another one. I've been collecting research for 20 years. We've kept prisoners down there for 15 years without charging them with any crime. There's a lot of lawyers who spend time down there trying to correct a terrible situation. It's also right down my alley because it's a legal system. But again, I can't get my head around that story. This is a little left field, but I was fascinated by the fact that as a young man, you held office in the Mississippi legislature. Could the 28-year-old version of you be elected in Mississippi today? At that time, I was, I'm not going to say conservative, I was a moderate Democrat. Today, that person doesn't exist in the South. If I ran today, I would hope that I would run as a progressive Democrat and I would not be elected. I have friends who hold public office in Mississippi who had to switch from Democratic to Republican to keep their jobs. If you have the D by your name, you're not going to get elected. It's changed dramatically in the last 30 years. Also, it ought to be against the law in any state for a 28-year-old to be elected to the state legislature. I see these guys. The guy from North Carolina, Madison Cawthorn, yeah, just got beat. It shows you what happens when a 26-year-old who's off-leash gets elected. He needed to be called home. You've got to be at least 30 years old and have some maturity before you get that job. I didn't do any damage in my 8 years, but there's not much of a record to brag about. I didn't do a lot of good. David, what was the most morally difficult decision you had to make as a politician or a practicing lawyer? I'll tell you a story. A 15-year-old girl in my church got pregnant. Her parents were devastated. Strict Southern Baptist, small town. They were terrified people were going to find out. They came to me before they went to the minister because they were talking about adoption, the laws. Abortion terrified them. The father was 15 years old, too, so getting married was out of the question. I remember thinking, these people are leaning on me way too much. I was a 27-year-old kid, 1 year out of law school. They think I'm wise. I'm not ready for this. The parents weren't a lot older than I was, in their early 40s, I guess. They reached a point where they trusted me, and I'm thinking, I don't want to be in this room. I finally said, let's get the minister involved. You people need help big time, and I'm not giving it to you. My point is, I realized that on the abortion issue, that was a decision to be made by that family, that girl and the parents and nobody else. Nobody else should be in the room, including the government. No government, no lawmaker, no judge. That's when I began to realize what's at stake with abortion. I'm opposed to abortion. I didn't want her to get an abortion because the baby was going to be healthy, and the baby did make a great gift for someone else. She was able to leave and go live with an aunt in another town, have the baby well cared for, adopted out. She came back, the family rallied, the church rallied. Maybe the best of a bad situation, and somebody got a beautiful baby. But there were times when I was thinking the quickest solution would be an abortion. I didn't say that, but it was a quandary I was in because I was getting way too much input. That had a big impact on me as a lawyer, because you realize the influence you have. The law degree is a powerful tool. You can do a lot of good things. That's the fun part of being a lawyer, when you help people. I was not a very good lawyer. Why not? You've got to be kind of tough on the business end, and I could never say no to people who are in trouble, especially people I knew in the community. When you take everything that walks in the door, you're going to go broke. That was my downfall. At the same time, I had strong ambitions about being a skilled courtroom lawyer. That was my goal, inspired by some great old-fashioned country lawyers in Mississippi I knew. I was never afraid of going to court. Most lawyers are. A lot of them are afraid to try a case in front of a jury. But I thrived on that. I dreamed of being so good that people with really good cases, injury cases or wrongful death cases or medical malpractice cases, would come to me and I would have the chance to make some money, which I never did. You said that you're opposed to abortion for religious reasons. I've just never been able to stomach the idea of abortion on demand or women having multiple abortions just because they get pregnant. And I've always thought that late-term abortions, partial birth abortions, were something that we shouldn't tolerate because the fetus is viable. I've always been turned off by that notion of abortion. I guess it's probably religious grounds, but at the same time, you don't know what you're going to do until you're in that situation. That's when it becomes a matter of choice. What political positions did you hold when you were 28 that you don't hold now? Death penalty, for sure. You used to believe in it? Big time. I'm in favor of tougher gun control. I'm much more suspicious of the police and prosecutors because I've seen so many wrongful convictions. Also, race relations. I grew up in the Jim Crow South, very segregated, racist society. It was almost in my DNA. It's a long struggle to overcome that and to look back at the way I was raised and not be resentful toward my parents and other people who helped raise me for their extreme racism. Such a hard, right-wing, racist society that I grew up in. The Baptist Church was that way too back then. I've come a long way. I have a lot of friends and even kinfolk who never tried to move beyond the racism, but I try every day. It's been an ongoing, gradual transformation. My wife was another factor, because she grew up in North Carolina, and it was not as hardcore racist as Mississippi. She and her parents were much more tolerant. So she's had a big influence on me. You know, we're all tribalists. We all want to be around our people or believe in our people. And it's often too hard to get beyond that. It's still a struggle for me. David said, has your sense of the South as a literary setting changed? To my mind, the open resurgence of racist violence makes a book like A Time to Kill read even more disturbingly today than it did when I first read it in the 90s. It's changed in many ways. That story is based on an actual assault that happened in the 70s in a small town not too far from where I lived and went to law school. When I wrote that story, I was 30 years old, and I had never written before. I can't tell you. There was a lot of careful forethought with A Time to Kill. I didn't think about the portrayal of Southern blacks and Southern whites in a small town. That was just my world. At the same period of time, in 1988, I was back from my second term at the legislature. We had a progressive young governor, a progressive young House Speaker. We thought, finally, Mississippi could change things. We are on the cusp of this progressive revolution. We believed it. 34 years later, it's astonishing how far backward the state has gone. The politics there are very displeasing to me. David says, let me shift gears. This could be apocryphal, but I heard that you and Michael Crichton used to have some one-upmanship over money. Each of you wanted to be paid a dollar more than the other guy. Is that true? In the 1990s, for about 5 years in a row, my agent would take my latest manuscript, Pelican Brief, The Client, The Chamber, the Rainmaker, to Hollywood, get the studios in a room and have an auction. And when they paid millions. I don't know what was actually said because I wasn't there, but it was like, Crichton got this amount, we want more. It was back and forth. We were gaming the system big time. It was working beautifully until it stopped. I sold the film rights to The Runaway Jury in 1996 to New Regency for a record amount. I can't get a fraction of that today. You can say, well, we choked the golden goose, but all those films made money. Then Hollywood changed. I don't understand that world. Nobody understands that world. There's no rules. We learned years ago, don't believe a word until they start filming. Runaway Jury was actually the last big contract I got. I helped write the script, which was a huge mistake. Joel Schumacher was the director. We had Sean Connery, Gwyneth Paltrow, Edward Norton ready to start filming. It was a done deal, and Joel Schumacher jumped off the bus. The whole cast walked away. It took years to make that movie. Why was it a mistake to work on the script? I'm not a screenwriter. It's not something I enjoy doing. One of the most frustrating parts is the teamwork. You get notes from people who don't have a clue, who don't understand the basics of storytelling. You wonder if they even make movies. The worst note I got, it's a great story, in 1993, 94, somewhere in there, the firm, the Pelican Brief, and the client came out in the span of about 12 months. All three books were at the top of the list, along with A Time to Kill, which had been rediscovered. Things were hopping. I was finishing The Chamber, and this was a stupid thing we did. A big-time Hollywood guy said, okay, we want to buy your next book right now, sight unseen. I sent the manuscript, what I had, and this studio honcho read the first draft of an incomplete manuscript and wasn't too crazy about it. It truly pissed me off. Suddenly, this guy's a literary critic. He sent a fax note, I believe, to my agent at the time and said, we can't buy this book for a movie unless Grisham will promise three love scenes and a happy ending. Laughs. If I ever write a Hollywood tell-all, that's the title of my book, Three Love Scenes and a Happy Ending. David, do you think about your critical legacy as a writer? When you get started in the business, you have some success, like I did with The Firm. You ought to be taken seriously as a writer, but you have to be honest with yourself. You can't sell books and be loved by critics. It's not going to happen. There are very few literary authors who sell a lot of books. The bestseller for a literary novel is 25,000 copies, 50 max. If you do sell a lot of books, you're dismissed by critics. So I decided a long time ago, I'll take the money and run. You talk about legacy, I don't care. I'm going to be dead and gone. And now I'll read a letter to the ethicist. The magazine's ethicist columnist on the financial betrayal, and more. My significant other and I have committed to being life partners. After living together for a year, we bought a house. We split the purchase cost and the cost of extensive renovations 50-50. We own the house in joint tenancy. We don't share any expenses other than household expenses and split those costs based on income. I've been very open about my finances and willingly give my partner access to all my accounts as he is retired from a career as a successful financial advisor. All I know about my partner's financial situation is what he tells me, that he has various sources of income and that his net worth is 1.5 times mine. I've respected his privacy and decision not to share financial information with me, and I've trusted him. Fairly split the cost of household expenses. I pay one-third, and he pays two-thirds. We review expenses periodically, but lately my partner has said more than once that I'm not paying my fair share. Last week, we picked up our separate tax returns at our accountant's office. We were standing together at a counter, and the clerk first handed my partner paperwork about e-filing to sign. I reflexively glanced over and inadvertently saw my partner's annual income. I felt like I'd been punched in the gut. My partner's annual income is 5 times what mine is. I haven't said anything, and I don't know if my partner's aware I saw his income. But now our division of costs for household expenses doesn't quite seem so fair. Based on income, my share would be 20% and his 80%. What now? Seems like trust is in the balance both ways. And the ethicist writes, this man was a financial advisor, and I would have thought that a useful piece of financial advice for two life partners is to be transparent about finances with each other. Learning his income shouldn't have come up as a gut punch. Now for a few caveats. You can't be absolutely sure that he lied about his net worth, which reflects the value of his estate minus his debts. Either way, it would be odd to apportion your relative expenses by net worth, which can fluctuate with the market value of your assets, including highly illiquid ones. But that's clearly wasn't the arrangement you two had. Otherwise, going by his reporting, your share would be 40%, not a third. If instead you paid in proportion to the income you now know him to have, your share would come to a sixth, not a fifth. Your response to what you discovered makes it plain that he's been misleading you about how much money he has. That's a breach of your agreement and an act of dishonesty. I doubt you'll be able to begin to restore your trust in him unless you let him know what you're feeling. Maybe his shifty ways are restricted to the realm of money. Maybe, though, he simply isn't worthy of your trust. People differ in respect of how much bad character they can tolerate in a partner. That punch to the gut, however, may reflect the realization that this man isn't the life partner you thought you committed yourself to. The fact that you, in turn, have kept from him what you've learned and how you feel about it, the fact, bluntly, that you're pretending to be in the dark, suggests that a serious trust deficit has settled between the two of you. Have that uncomfortable talk. But it may not be possible to pay this deficit down. I'll end with a poem by Jay Hoppler, Love and the Memory of It. Spook not at the shook world with all its viruses and murder hornets. Instead, that summer evening called to mind when you drove alone over Iowa, the light in the fields, how long it was, how in love you were with it and the air and the world and that girl, that atomic girl you would one day marry. Or summon up a summer evening, half a life from then, and the park by the river, the way her laughter echoed off the rocks in sparks that sighed into the water. It was she that lit the world just then, and not that ember of a sun. Her light, like a struck string fretting its zing against the picnic tables. May that be the music you hear when they unplug the ventilator. The poet Jay Hoppler currently has a terminal illness, and I'll read the poem again. Love and the Memory of It. Spook not at the shook world with all its viruses and murder hornets. Instead, that summer evening, call to mind when you drove alone over Iowa, the light in the fields, how long it was, how in love you were with it, and the air and the world, and that girl, that atomic girl you would one day marry. Or summon up a summer evening, half a life from then, and the park by the river, the way her laughter echoed off the rocks in sparks that sighed into the water. It was she that lit the world just then, and not that ember of a sun. Her light, like a struck string fretting its zing against the picnic tables. May that be the music you hear when they unplug the ventilator. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.